Hi, everybody. It's Micha Sifri from Personal Democracy Forum. Welcome again to yet another in our regular series of PDF Network conference calls with movers, shakers, and all the people who are making change and doing the work of our business. I'm getting a little feedback. I hope that's going to go away. Yeah, seems to have gone away. This week, we're going to be looking at really just about everything you might want to know and we're afraid to ask about email benchmarks. Our guests are Mark Rubin and Karen Matheson from M&R Strategic Services. Mark is the Vice President for e-campaigns there, and Karen is the Manager of Quantitative Research and Analysis. I should say that M&R is pretty much God when you want to find out how to fine-tune your email strategy, what subject lines will work, what open rates are good. These are the people you want to talk to. So we're really thrilled to have them for the next hour. I want to, as always, thank our sponsors AT&T and the Bivings Group for making these calls possible. And as you are getting on, just remember to mute your phones. Take a look at the ReadyTalk screen. Sign in there so you can see the slides that Karen and Mark are going to be walking us through. We're going to give them the first 10 or 15 minutes to introduce their research from the 2009 e-nonprofit benchmark study. I'll then ask them some questions. At any point, you can type a question into the chat, and about halfway through, we'll try and open up the call for anybody who's listening in to chime in, and hopefully we'll have a good, robust discussion of this really important subject. So, Mark and Karen, show's all yours.
All right. Well, thank you so much. I'm a little bit intimidated to be the voice of God, apparently. I don't know if God is the right description, but we do have some good data, and data-ness is next to godliness.
Mm-hmm.
Welcome, everyone. Thank you for joining us. I'm just going to quickly introduce the topic, and then Karen will talk a little bit more about the methodology of our study and some of the big-picture fundraising findings. And then I will talk about messaging findings and list growth from the 2009 e-nonprofit benchmark study, which is a study that is the most recent of a series that we've been doing for a few years now, where we analyze data from multiple nonprofits of different kinds and aggregate that data to come up with some statistics that you can use to measure your own online program. It's the 2009 study measures data from 2008, so we're now obviously well into 2009. So some of this data is at this point getting a little bit old, but I think it's still a really useful exercise to know how things are changing in a longer time span, and also what kinds of data you might want to be measuring about your program and how it compares to other nonprofits in your field. 2008 was obviously a big year for the stuff that we do with the election. There was unprecedented, I think, online engagement, and with that comes what I'm sure we've all seen this year, which is some outsized expectations about what is possible through online advocacy and fundraising. So we'll use this time to talk through the results that we saw in 2008 and a little bit how you can use them in your own organization to model your program and make it better. We use this data for forecasting list growth and advocacy and fundraising. When we're making decisions about starting up with an organization doing online fundraising, do we want to do standalone appeals versus sustainer appeals? Do we want to restrict our audiences for some of our advocacy appeals? So we use this data a lot. And before I hand it over to Karen to introduce how we did the study, I want to just thank N10, which is our partner in putting this study together, the Nonprofit Technology Network. They're definitely an amazing source for information and resources, and you should definitely check them out if you haven't already. And also a big shout out to our nonprofit study partners. And if you look at your screen now, I'll show some of the logos of the folks who participated in the study, and they collected a huge amount of data. And Karen, if you want to take it away, we can learn a little bit more about that.
Sure. Let's go to the next slide. So with the study, and what Mark was saying earlier is that at MNR we're really data-driven. So pretty much any decision we make about our online communications programs that we advise is really backed up just by a ton of data and testing. So that's kind of why this study is so important, because I think it's really helpful for organizations that can't afford fancy consultants that have these vast amounts of data to tell us what to do. It's kind of a good way for some of the smaller organizations and organizations that might not have the benefit of some of the consulting work that we do to kind of have this overall picture of what some of the large organizations are doing. So kind of what we did was we went to 32 different nonprofit organizations, and in those organizations we broke up data based on what type of organization they were. So we had the civil and legal rights organizations in the study. We had environmental groups. We had international aid. And we had health organizations. And then the last segment that we looked at of data or sector is the local organizations. So we took organizations that were from local, state-based, or city-based organizations. So that was kind of the new component that we added in this most recent study that's interesting if you're a smaller organization to look at. And the data we looked at is January 2007 to December of 2008. So when we're looking at some of the comparisons by year in the slides that we're going to look at next, we're looking at January through December. So it's just a simple calendar year that we looked at for our data. And what makes this study so interesting is that we actually went through and asked the organizations that participated to go through every single email that they had sent out in the 2007 and 2008 year. So when Mark was thanking the partners, that's really important because they had to go through line by line and look at each message and put it and tell us what type of message it was. And there was over 10,000 of those. And then we looked at lists where if you combine all these 32 organizations, it was 10 million subscribers. And then we looked at each email advocacy action that people had taken, and those were over 3 million. And then we looked at about totally combined $100 million in online donations. So we looked at a very large set of data over these 32 nonprofit organizations.
Yeah.
And let me just jump in here. I just want to remind everyone, if you can mute your phones, we're getting a little background noise.
Tito had a call last night.
Hey, someone
didn't
hear that.
Muted is on another line. So.
All right.
We'll talk loud.
Okay, so looking at some of these key findings, and the first thing we want to start out with fundraising, because that's always the most interesting, where's the money at?
Yep.
We have the next slide, Mark.
Yep, here we go.
And we got a call about 2 in the morning.
So this first slide that you're looking at, this is email fundraising response rate. So a response rate is when you send out an email, it's the number of people that did the thing that you asked them to do, yeah, divided by the number of people that received that message that you sent them. And what we're looking at here is the dark bars in green are 2007 data, and the light bars with the lighter green is 2008 data. And then we've broken the data up by sector. So the first two bars that you see is all sectors. And what you can see from that is there really wasn't a big change in response rate from 2007 to 2008. It was across all of sectors. And that was about a 0.12% response rate.
Okay. All right. Yeah. There. Cool. Okay. Thanks, Andy. Hello. Have we lost you guys?
I'm still here.
Karen?
Looks like we're having some mute issues.
Right.
Tried to get rid of that person there.
Okay. Karen, are you there? Sorry about this, folks.
I'm here.
Okay.
Can you hear me?
Yes, we've got you.
Yeah.
Oh, great.
Okay. And I believe we've managed to mute the person who forgot to mute their phone.
It wasn't me, that was the offender.
Okay, go ahead. Sorry for the interruption.
So I'll start back at the beginning here and the change in online giving from 2007 to 2008. So in the last slide, we saw that our actual response rates when we're sending out messages aren't any different. But when we're looking at actual amounts that people have donated, we have seen some differences. So we see that the percent change in gifts overall to these nonprofit organizations was 43%. So we saw a growth in number of gifts that people were giving. And then we saw also the amount change in donated we saw was a 26% growth. So people were giving more gifts, but they weren't, all the gifts didn't equal as much money. So they were kind of giving more gifts, but they were smaller gifts. And we kind of see this illustrated on the next slide. So in this next slide, in the dark green again is the 2007 trend line of average gifts by month. And the light line is the average gift by month in 2008. And what you can see is they kind of follow the same path. But then when you look at the last quarter of the year, which is the end of year giving, which happens to be where most people give the bulk of their money, we see that the average gift dropped quite a bit in 2008. So it really kind of illustrates why we saw this rise in number of gifts people were giving, but we saw this kind of decrease in amount of growth because they were giving more gifts, but it was the amounts that they were giving were less than the number that went up.
And one thing sorry, go ahead.
Oh, no, I was going to ask if you have anything to say about that.
Yeah, the one thing I would say is just the end of year giving time is obviously the big time for most of us nonprofits. And so that major drop in giving in that very important time actually was what drove the overall decrease in average gifts from 2007 to 2008.
This is Micha. I just want to interrupt on this question. It's very interesting because you have 2 years worth of data. And do you guys have any observations on what it means for nonprofits competing with people's money in an election year? You know, to a certain degree, the off-year donations might be higher in 2007 exactly because in 2008 people are being tapped to give money to political candidates. Do you think that,
well,
given the size of the universe you're looking at, I don't know if that's true, but, mm-hmm. you know, what do you think?
Interestingly enough, this is the graph that shows exactly, you know, what happened and when.
Mm-hmm.
So if you look at September, when a huge amount of political fundraising was going on, in that year...
In 08.
In 08,
mm-hmm.
the light green line, I'll see if I can highlight it right here for you. Well, that's not really very clear. in 2008, the light green line for September, you actually have a higher average gift.
Mm-hmm.
People were doing a ton of political donating in June, July, August, September, and it wasn't until October when we saw the economy start to go sour, that the light green line dipped below. I think it's almost, you know, you what you might have seen is that trend increase that you saw in September, where 2008 average gifts were higher than 2007 gifts. So I actually don't think that the political giving, at least in terms of average gift, and we see the same thing on the response rate graph, was having that big of an impact. I think it's really more the economy.
Mm, okay. And Greg Heller is pointing out in the chat that there was plenty of fundraising for presidential candidates in 2007 also. Mm-hmm. And one might think that the level of political activity around the elections could be a rising tide that lifts all boats. It basically expands the universe of people who are,
right.
you know, getting comfortable making an email donation.
Right.
Yeah, we definitely saw that for sure, because a lot of these nonprofits in the study happen to be organizations that did do targeted funding appeals around election issues.
Yeah.
Okay.
So yeah, that's an interesting question. But I think the other thing I would say to Greg's point actually is you'd think you'd see some major shift between, you know, January, February, and March of both of these years and August and September. Whereas you're not seeing, you know, it's not a major difference in July and August and September for political, you know, during political giving time.
Mm-hmm.
So moving on, so that was fundraising, and now we want to do some of the findings on our messaging stats. Open rates, click-through rates, that sort of thing. We were able to really learn a lot, like Karen said, from the individual hand coding of messages that our study partners did. So first, in terms of open rates, you can see there was only a slight decline in open rates during the first quarter of the year. And the overall decline was definitely not as marked as what we saw in the previous year's study. There was a 1% decline overall during the course of this year, 2008 versus 2007, and in the previous study we saw a decrease of 3%. So it looks like that decline in open rates is generally leveling off. And as many of you probably know, open rates are heavily dictated by a lot of factors other than, you know, is someone interested in the subject line? Because the way that we track open rates is by downloading images. So as software changes, so do the open rates. I think it's interesting to note that September was one month in which open rates were actually higher in 2008 than in 2007. Despite the fact that message volume was also up dramatically in that month, as we'll see a couple slides later. So likely due to some excitement around the election, organizations were sending more messages, but subscribers were also opening more messages. And I think that's, you know, some proof to what we all kind of sense is true, which is that it really depends on how interesting the content that you're giving people is, as to whether they're going to open and respond. So you can actually be giving them more emails as long as it's something that's really interesting to them, they'll keep responding. Whereas usually the open rates are, you know, and response rates are relatively in inverse proportion to the volume of email that you're sending. The more you send, the less people do. On to click-through rates. They followed a similar trend, a pretty steady decline at the end of the year with a very sharp decline in September. Of course, a lot of what's going on in September is fundraising appeals, and fundraising appeals have much lower click-through rates than other emails. And once again here, in September, we see a bump in click-through rates, even though there was much heavier messaging in that month compared to 2007. Mm-hmm. On to a slide that breaks down different types of messaging, fundraising appeals, email newsletters, and advocacy alerts. And the thing that I would direct your attention to here is the right-hand column of response rates, because that's really the be-all, end-all of our of what we want to measure in email marketing. That's what matters, is people doing what you ask them to do, no matter how many people click and open. So what we see here is interesting, that despite those declines in open rate and click-through rate that we just saw, response rates are actually relatively flat. 2007 to 2008 fundraising response rates are completely flat, and advocacy response rates, that little 4.8 to 4.5% difference is actually not statistically significant. So you can think of those as having stayed flat as well. So why would open rates decline and click-through rates decline, but response rates stay the same? Maybe there's a little bit less curiosity or a sense of novelty about online advocacy and fundraising. People have gotten these emails a lot. They know what they're going to see on the page when they click through. So fewer people are kind of clicking through to check it out, but aren't going to take action or donate. People know what's there.
And I just wanted to mention, too, that in the back of the study, if you download the free copy of that, we actually give these breakouts by sector.
Yeah, so if you want to see not just the overall fundraising response rate, but the fundraising response rate just for environmental organizations, you can see that there. Next, we have a really interesting slide, which is something that we were able to do for the first time this year, which is breakout emails by the type of email. So what you can see here is, and once again, I would look at the right-hand column here, which represents, compared to a regular advocacy email, how does each of these different types of emails compare in terms of the click-through rate. So, for example, a telefriend email is likely to get about a 10% smaller click-through rate than a regular advocacy email. And those numbers on the right will allow you to compare not just the industry benchmarks, but if you know what your regular advocacy response rate is, you can, when you send out a survey, say, okay, well, you know, we can expect to get an only slightly smaller click-through rate. And we did click-through rate for all of these since there's not a trackable response for many of these types of emails. So if you do a volunteer sign-up, you know, a lot of times that's going to be going in and calling or filling out a form that's not necessarily trackable. So we used click-through rate as a useful guide. It's worth noting, though, that in the study, if you download it, there are response rates broken down for some of these, and we'll talk about that a little bit later.
And also, I wanted to clarify to Aaron's question, how are we defining a regular advocacy? And that's that just means that you have a form that you click on that says, fill out this form and hit submit button. So that's email advocacy, something where we get an electronic response from sending an email or an electronic email that will send a fax to a senator or legislator or something like that.
Sign a petition, that would be another example.
Right, exactly.
Yep. Yes. Thank you. So on to some key findings on list growth. So overall, list growth, you can see on the far left here, for all the sectors combined, list growth was down from 19% list growth to 17% growth in 2008 versus 2007. And I think that was, you know, likely to some extent due to sort of the maturation of a lot of larger nonprofit lists. We've gone through some of that low-hanging fruit of easy recruitment, getting people who are poised and ready to join your list, and now people are going to have to work a little bit harder for it. And
can I just ask you a question that
uh-huh.
goes to your methodology? So if I remember, you had about 10 million emails as part of the data set. So are we saying that of these 32 groups that pooled their information, that the total universe of recipients were 10 million people, 10 million email addresses, or we don't know?
Good question. That means it's if I were to add each list up together, that equals 10 million. And then when we're talking about this annual list growth, how I did the numbers was I said, okay, person A or organization A has 100,000 people this year and 150,000 people. So I did that for each organization, and then I made an average growth for each one, and then I took an average of that. So it's kind of an overall average of everybody's single
okay. But the overall universe, you know, when you're saying maybe they've matured, it's not necessarily that there are 10 million unique individuals
right.
collectively being reached here. There could be a lot of overlap.
Yes.
Exactly.
There is likely a lot of overlap.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, this isn't looking at the overall universe of
right. I mean, again, theorizing, you know, nobody really knows what the denominator is to this. But, you know, if Barack Obama had 13 million email addresses and, you know, some number of those are duplicates or people who are outside the United States, and if John McCain had, say, 8 or 9 million, you know, what's the total number of Americans with email addresses who are, you know, sort of paying attention to issues? But
right.
So this is clearly a smaller universe.
Yeah, yeah, that's a great question. This is definitely a smaller, you know, 32 nonprofits is a lot of nonprofits for a study, but it's not. It's a tiny drop in the bucket.
So many of them are large nonprofits. I mean,
many of them are large. Yeah,
yeah,
it's certain.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, there's some that have a million plus people on their list, so it's quite large.
Yeah. So that's growth. Now on to email list churn, which is the rate at which email addresses go bad in a given year. They might go bad due to unsubscribing. They might go bad due to bouncing, people's email addresses changing. But for whatever reason, they became unreachable in that given 12-month period. And it's the percentage of subscribers who became unreachable divided by the total number of subscribers in the system during that period. So you can see here the breakdown. Overall, 19% churn. 19% of email addresses go bad in a given year. And of those, 6% unsubscribed and 13% were, you know, a combination of bouncing and spam. And this 90% is basically the same as what we saw in 2007. So churn is something that you can and should plan for on your list, and it doesn't seem to be changing that much year over year. So I want to close out with a couple interesting slides where we dig a little bit deeper into the data. We'll spend just a couple more minutes on this show you some interesting things that might have bearing on what you do in your own program. This is a slightly complicated slide to look at, but what we're looking at here is the breakdown of who takes how much action on your list. So if you look on the left-hand bar, you can see the breakdown of overall on these lists that we studied, how many people who have taken at least one action during this year are basic activists, i.e. they took one-time activists, they took one action. Basic activists, they took 2 to 5 actions. Or super activists, they took 6 or more actions. And this was just a breakdown that we decided. But a lot of organizations kind of have some definitions like this for their targeting. So you can see that those one-time activists make up a large portion of the population on the list. And only 7% are the super activists who take 6 or more actions. But that 7% of super activists was responsible for 31% of the actual actions taken. And this breakdown is similar for a given email. So if you send out an email to everyone who's taken action, you'll get a lot more actions from your super activists because they're so much more likely to respond. One thing that is interesting about this observation is that you can use this to when other folks at your organization are clamoring to get an email out on something, and you know it's not the kind of thing that is going to be most interesting to your subscribers, you can feel pretty good about sending it to one of these higher performing groups, sending it just to super activists or sending it to super activists and basic activists, and knowing that you'll get almost as many actual actions out of it as you would by sending it to your whole list. So it can be, some fodder if you want to restrict some of your actions a little bit.
Question. Action is a pretty broad term. Are there types of actions that predominate
We actually had to define for the purposes of studying this any simple online action. So in other words, a petition, writing to Congress, a basic, simple online action. We're not talking about donations here. We're not talking about higher threshold actions like phone calls and stuff. Most organizations that we studied and most organizations in general aren't quite sophisticated enough to be tracking all of those different types of actions, i.e. signing up for a volunteer event, making a phone call, as trackable actions. So this is just regular old basic, respond to an action alert.
Mm-hmm.
So here's a similar concept, but for donations. And what we can see here on the left is the number of gifts overall. This is just online gifts, not offline gifts, compared to the total amount raised. Up at the top you have the higher dollar donors, and down at the bottom you have the lower dollar donors. That dark green is gifts less than $50. And the thing to note here is that when we compare this breakdown to the previous year's breakdown, lower dollar donations are a growing slice of the pie. That under $50 dark green chunk right here represents 61% of all the gifts given. That is up 10% from the year before. It was 51% the year before. If you look at the above 250, so the slightly higher dollar ones, which are way up at the top there, the gray, yellow, and blue bars, those represent only 3% of the total number of gifts in 2008, whereas in 2007 they represented 7% of the total number of gifts. So on the right-hand column you can see there's still a big chunk of the overall pie in terms of dollars raised, but it's clear that the growth in online fundraising in 2008 was driven by low-dollar gifts. High-dollar gifts are a smaller number and a smaller total amount of the donations. Another interesting thing that you can use for your own, measuring your own program here is response rates for advocacy for different segments of your list. A lot of organizations are doing a lot better job of not sending everything to everyone. Small is the new big, and we're seeing a lot more creativity with slicing and dicing your file and sending things to people who are in particular areas or have particular interest areas. And this chart represents the difference, 0% baseline being just your standard action alert sent to the full list, what happens when you send that to a smaller portion of the list? So the first line there, what happens when you send a resend of an action alert to people who didn't take action the first time? So non-action taker resend.
Mm.
What we see here is that, sure, of course, the response rate drops, as you would expect it would, because you already scooped up all the people who were interested the first time. But it only drops by 50%. And for those of you who think, well, they didn't respond the first time, that must mean they're not interested, I think it's interesting here to note that you can actually get a 50% bump, and you can expect a 50% bump on the number of actions that you've generated if you resend a message with a similar action to the folks who didn't take action. So just because you sent them the email the first time and they didn't respond doesn't mean they're not interested. In fact, half of them, half of the response rate is about what you can expect when you resend stuff like that. Everything else that we're looking at here is a positive change. In other words, when we restricted the audience, we got more of a response, a higher response rate than we did with the full file. So if we targeted it by geography in the second bar, you can expect a 41% bump over your full file response rate. You target by interest area, in other words, people who have shown by taking action that they have a particular interest in this area that you're talking about, that is about a 55% increase. And then when we look at folks who took action recently, they've already demonstrated not only that they're interested in that issue, but that they've just taken action very recently, and then, you know, maybe you send them another action related to that. They are 200% more likely to take action with full file. And we also broke this down for donations, and we see that similarly, you can expect a 222% increase in your response rate when you send a fundraising appeal just to your donors. And this is the first time that we've been able to do this type of analysis, because our study partners coded every single one of their messages and said, did this go to the full list? Did this go to folks who recently took action? Did this go to just donors? So when you send out an email to your to a restricted portion of your list, this can help you figure out what kind of response rate you can expect.
And this is definitely something I think for the nonprofit field to think about as well, because this is the first time that many of these national nonprofits thought about coding the messages in a uniform and standard way. So the stuff that came out of it was stuff that MNR had created just because we have multiple clients that wanted to see these breakdowns. So if any of you are interested in kind of using the same coding scheme as us, feel free to get a hold of us and we can kind of give you the rubric if you ever want to do this to your own list.
So I just want to go to the last slide here. Whoops, went a little too far there. Sorry, hold on. Average unsubscribe rates per email message by month. So this goes back to what we were talking about the impact of the election. Just real interesting to note, even though we saw that there's obviously a lot more messaging going out around the election.
You mean in the fall?
Yes, in the fall.
Right.
Even though there's a lot more messaging going out, we actually saw a decrease in the unsubscribe rates. You might expect to see a big spike in unsubscribes during the election because of all that messaging, but that's not what happened. So, you know, there's always the eternal question, often not easily answerable, about how much email is too much. And of course, we all know it kind of depends on what your organization you're working for. And the lame answer is, if you don't have, you know, if you don't have something interesting to say, people are going to unsubscribe. If you do have something interesting to tell people, they'll stick around. And this is proof of that. And with that, I'd turn it back over to Mika for some questions.
Sure. And since we only have about 20 minutes left, I'm going to throw the floor open to everybody else who's on the call too. I'm going to just quickly ask one question and then let other people who are listening in, if they want to chime in, though, feel free to type your question into the chat too. The good news from this is that even as email lists have grown substantially overall, the general response rate hasn't gone down that significantly. So, you know, one interpretation is, however people are growing their lists, the quality of the people joining those lists hasn't been degraded, right? I mean, I one underlying thing about the study that comes out in the report is that a lot of these groups are using new methods to spread their message and acquire members, right? They're using video, they're using text, they're using social networking platforms. And so would you, you know, is it fair to generalize that, you know, if somebody is worrying, well, you know, we might get a lot of people interested because we made some funny video, but that doesn't mean they're going to be the same quality members that we get from our tried and true methods. What this study seems to show is, no, you don't have to fear that.
Yeah, I think that's right. I think to some degree, once you've got someone engaged on a list, the initial, as we all know, or maybe we don't, but we've seen in our work that organic sources of recruits, which includes videos and social media and text messaging, stuff where it's friends telling friends, rather than, and that's earned outreach rather than paid outreach, tends to produce higher quality recruits, people who, you know, because they're a little bit more trusting maybe, end up being more loyal. And I think as we see more organizations try those new methods, I think you're right. What we see here is that it's not the overall quality of lists isn't necessarily decreasing, and certainly not in the way that we saw it decrease, you know, 2 and 3 years ago.
Folks on the call want to ask a question, just unmute your phone and say who you are and try and keep the question short. Can you say, well, I'm going to continue that. Can you guys say a little bit more about the local part of this study? I noticed that some of these, the data in here is really different because it's coming from much smaller lists. Do local email lists do better? You might think that they would because presumably the people on that list know the folks in the organization perhaps in a more intimate face-to-face way.
Yeah, I mean, that's an interesting question, too, because I think the difficult piece of that is with this year, this is the first time we added the local organizations, so it's actually really difficult to even get their data because many of them, this is the first time they've actually taken data like click-through rates and response rates and actually tracked it enough to give us the data. And I know that in a lot of cases, sometimes they were lower and sometimes they were higher. Overall, in general, they did seem to perform a little better on some things, like their click-through rates were a little bit better overall for newsletters, their advocacy messages. They had pretty poor page completion rates and response rates, and some of that was kind of due to their technology issues because they used different platforms than these big organizations that have, you know, access to Convio and Contera and get access to some of the bigger tools where they're able to track that stuff better. So I feel like the anecdotally that's true, that the local organizations did get a better response for some types of things, but also many of them don't have some of the background and experience that large nonprofits have to make, you know, data-informed decisions. So in that respect, sometimes they were a little bit below the mark.
So I'm going to read the question from Erin Hoftig, since she's in a noisy place. She says, on open rates, I'd like your thoughts on what nonprofits are doing early in the calendar year to keep those higher, to mark a difference from political campaigns whose open rates in January, February are abysmal. And your study obviously shows the early part of the year seems to be the best time for open rates.
Well, what you're looking at here, I think, is an artifact not so much of strategy, but of content. In January, almost no one is fundraising. So, and, you know, people are kind of starting to get back into it in February. But they're not, you know, if you're on kind of a, you know, four times a year big fundraising campaign schedule, January is not when you're doing a big fundraising campaign. So what you're seeing there in that bump is when you're sending out emails that aren't fundraisers, people open them and click through on them more. So when you're so that bump in performance in the beginning of the year is really more based on the fact that it's not fundraising appeals. And when you're looking at donate now messages, many people don't open them because they know they don't want to donate. But in January you're getting fewer of those.
It's an easier ask.
Yeah, exactly.
Okay. Other questions from people on the call? Just introduce yourself, unmute.
I will anticipate one question because I know that the data here from 2008, you know, we started to see the impact of the financial crisis at the end of the year, but many people are probably wondering, well, what's going on in 2009? And while we haven't obviously collected data from our 32 study partners in 2009, we do aggregate data from our clients at M&R, and just anecdotally, I can tell you that fundraising response rates are down a little bit, about 0.01% in 2009 versus 2008 for these January to August months. Average gifts are down quite a bit. They're down about $5 for email during these months. So the trend, I think, continues that average gifts are going down, and that's the main effect of what we're seeing happening with the economy. It's not so much that response rates are changing, but that average gifts are going down, and then overall gifts declining because of average gifts going down.
Mm-hmm. Not surprising.
Right.
This is something that we talked a little bit about in preparation for the call. To what degree are you finding the sort of only go to your list when you've got some urgent piece of news driving attention? You know, what are the lessons for people here? Should they wait and strike when the iron is hot, or just have a program and stick to their program? We're going to email this many people every month. You know, we're going to do something regular.
Well, yeah, it's a fascinating question. I think we all intuitively understand that when things are urgent and tied to real-world deadlines and news, they almost always do better. It's certainly true that a fundraising appeal that strikes a chord that people already care about because they've seen it on the news, because it's out there in the ether, in the media, always does better than something where you have to educate them in your email about what it is that's going on and why they should donate to it. That said, as a programmatic strategy, I think the sort of ineluctable realities of being a nonprofit mean that many of these, you know, advocacy-oriented nonprofits have to make a budget. They have a cash flow that they need to comply with throughout the year, and they need to plan campaigns for certain times of the year, no matter whether there's something in the news or not. And I think the organizations that have the most success are those who can be flexible and can slightly change that strategy or, you know, rewrite that appeal series to reflect what's going on in the environment when there is something, you know, notable and timely going on.
Right.
And that's kind of what you see so much, the trending data that we're looking at when we look at the international organizations. You can really see their numbers jumping around, you know, what's in the media and what natural disasters have happened.
Mm-hmm. It's not surprising. I'm going to keep going unless someone wants to interrupt. Folks on this call know I always have more questions. were any of the groups in this study doing sort of networked fundraising the way we saw the Obama campaign give its supporters their own tools to kind of turn around and fundraise amongst their own peers? The Obama MIBO platform supposedly generated something like $70 million out of the $500 million raised online came from activists using MIBO's tools to sort of be their own micro fundraisers.
Yeah.
Is anybody doing that?
Yeah, absolutely. And it's especially popular and lucrative, I think, with health groups.
Give me an example of one.
The MS Society or Susan G. Komen for the Cure or the American Lung Association.
Mm-hmm.
It's particularly lucrative, I think, around thon fundraising, so walkathons, bikeathons, marathons, that sort of thing.
Mm-hmm.
I haven't seen as much success with personal fundraising around groups that aren't sort of top-line single-issue groups, groups that might represent something that either because you or a family member is struck with an illness or a disease, or because you're talking about Barack Obama, issues that are the top of mind, top one or two issues in your life. Organizations that you know, especially like international organizations, environmental organizations, I think it's a tougher sell to raise enough through that kind of personal fundraising to justify the amount of resources that go into managing something like that. So it's working for those big top level, most important issue in my life type organizations, and those happen to often be health. But I think it's tougher for other organizations.
Are other organizations trying those techniques, or you're saying that they aren't even trying them?
A lot of them aren't even trying them, and among the ones that are, my sense, just anecdotally, is that it's often just a trickle,
mm-hmm.
And often not even enough to be like worth the staff time to do it.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Very interesting.
Yeah.
Other questions from the Peanut Gallery. The Quiet Peanut Gallery today. What are your next steps for? I assume you're going to repeat this study. And for people on this call, is there a way for organizations to get themselves plugged in? And if you participate, do you get more information out the other end?
Yes, and yes. There is a plan to do another one this year. We'd love to have anyone and everyone participate, and you can just email me. You've got my, actually both Karen and my emails on the
Yeah, I'm going to make sure that goes to everybody on the chat.
Sure that goes out. Or just go to mrss.com, which is MNR's website. And everyone's welcome to participate and encouraged, and many of the organizations find it's a great learning experience, and that many of them are for the first time capturing data that they always kind of knew that they should but never really got around to. And then we do provide, for all those study partners, an individualized little analysis of what does your data look like compared to the benchmarks that we provided. So that's kind of our thank you to you. And we'll send you some chocolate.
Chocolate?
Yeah.
No. Should have mentioned that earlier.
Save the best for last.
But it is a bit of work for groups to do this kind of analysis.
It definitely is. And if you're, you know, potentially interested, we can give you a better idea of how much work it is. But like I said, many of them feel like, oh, we're finally, you know, getting up to speed and really looking at a lot of things in our program that we should be looking at.
Mm-hmm.
And they come back for the chocolate.
Right. Right. Understandable. Well, great. So, and when will that be coming out? When should we watch for that?
I don't know. I can't make any promises. We have clients to serve, and for some reason that always seems to take precedence over these grand schemes. So.
Sure. Well, it's a really invaluable piece of work that helps the entire sector have a better idea of, you know, just what is the lay of the land, what are realistic goals, what are sort of tried and true strategies to achieve those goals. And, you know, so I strongly recommend that everybody take a close look at the full study, which I've put the link up to, the 2009 eNonprofit Benchmark Study. Mark Rubin and Karen Matheson from MNR Strategic Services, I really want to thank you. This has been fascinating. I think everybody has learned a lot, and this is great information that people can continue to use in their own work. So we really appreciate you making the time for this PDF Network call.
Thank you so much for having us.
Our pleasure.
It's been really interesting.
I'm going to just remind everybody, we have another really interesting call coming up next Thursday with Elise Hoag from MoveOn.org. And she's going to be talking with us about the virtual organization model. How do you have an organization with 30 staffers and no common office? How do they manage to coordinate with more and more people telecommuting these days, with more organizations sort of having far-flung staffers? We thought it'd be really interesting to see how an organization like Move On actually manages this communications challenge, what tools they use. So next Thursday, 1 o'clock Eastern Time, should be a really interesting call. Again, I want to thank AT&T and the Bivings Group for sponsoring these PDF Network calls and making them possible. And to Karen and Mark, thanks again for your time. Everybody else, we'll see you online, and see you next week.